Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
My name is Angelo Carasone, better known as Stop Back on Twitter, and primarily I spend my time trying to debunk right-wing lies that permeate our media, and there's, you know, one of the places that we do it is on Bob Carson's show.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013, and you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Jason Leopold of TruthOut.org, and you're listening to Carson's Corner, only on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is David Levitt, your host from SYM Radio. SYM Radio is helping raise awareness to missing persons, parental stranger abductions, and human trafficking through our partners. We also raise awareness that people with disabilities can do whatever they set their mind to the love of God and Christ. And we're proud to be an affiliate with Carson's Corner, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Jay Ray and Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio and also at symradio.com/live.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
Blog Talk Radio. My name is Bob Carson. Glad to be with you this Sunday afternoon. For once, I have a weekend day off, so I could do the show. Okay. I don't mind working weekends. I don't, but every once in a while, I want to have a weekend day off and just do something. And that happens to be this radio show. That's what I'm doing today. 347-326-9749 is the number for you to be a part of the program. 347-326-9749. We also have the chat room open for you. Anybody is welcome in the chat room. Comments, questions, or concerns, just show some respect in there. Okay? Don't be too belligerent. And don't launch these ridiculous accusations. Don't troll me, because I don't have any tolerance for trolls. Let me tell you what we got coming up here today. It's just going to be me. We're going to be talking about everything that's going on around us. And I got to tell you, I'm really getting sick of the coverage of the Boston bombers, or the live bomber. What's his name? Dzhokhar Dzhonaev. I'm just getting sick and tired of it. Are you getting sick and tired of it? Do we need to hear about this? I mean, what's done is done. I mean, you know, the media really obsesses over these cases. They're interested in sensationalizing what happened to get ratings, and unfortunately, and I admit that I really was captivated by this like you were. You know, I was very, very interested after the bombing occurred, the investigation, and then ultimately the police chase, which resulted in Tamerlan, the older brother, being killed, shot, and then eventually run over by his brother, and then the eventual capture of his younger brother. But I'm sick and tired of it. You know, I don't want to hear this anymore. I'm just, you know, the mainstream media really just obsesses about these cases. And it's unfortunate because, you know, the whole terrorism angle, and these guys were terrorists, as I've said. There's no question about that. They were converts to Islam. At least the older brother was. He'd went to Russia for 6 months, and the Russian government actually contacted our government and said that they believed this man was radicalized. The FBI interviewed him twice, and they put him in some sort of a database with about 850,000 other people, and that was it. And that was the extent to what happened. We knew about him because he was in the immigration system. They'd come to this country apparently legally. They weren't here illegally, as I understand. And so that we knew who they were. Their family actually received welfare benefits, over $100,000 in welfare benefits for the entire family and whatnot. And so there's no question these guys are terrorists. But I got to tell you, what really bothers me is we've seen a lot of violence in this country over the past 5 years, particularly since the nomination of President Barack Obama. There's just no question about that. We've seen an increase in right-wing militia activity. We've seen an increase, seemingly, in mass shootings around America. And these people are not committed, or not called terrorists by the media. That really bothers me. James Holmes, the nutjob who went into an Aurora movie theater and ultimately killed 12 people and wounding over 70 people. There was somebody posted this on Facebook. I forget who. I'm sorry. I'm not able to give any type of attribution here. But they said, you know, this guy wounds 71 people, kills 12 people, and he's not a terrorist. He's just a madman, right? He's just a nut job. He's not a terrorist. No, we can't call him a terrorist. Timothy McVeigh killed 168 people. He's not a terrorist. He was just a madman. You see, that this is the double standard that exists within our media. And I don't want to harp on this because I've spoken about this on other shows. Okay, I've really gone in depth about how the media considers people that commit acts of violence using guns as just madmen, and you know, individuals that are Islamic are somehow terrorists. There's no such thing as a white Christian terrorist in America. Eric Rudolph was not a terrorist. Timothy McVeigh was not a terrorist. David Koresh, no, he's not a terrorist. Terrorism only fits Muslim people, just like welfare only fits black people and minority people, right? That's what we're led to believe by our corporate media. So the take-home message here is to disregard the corporate media, the sensationalism in the corporate media, and don't watch it. Tune into shows like this and others out there that are sick and tired of the corporate media and the in-the-box type of analysis that we hear so often. We're going to talk about some other things going on here. And we've got Justin Ray Harvey is coming back to the show. He's going to be calling in later in the show, and it's going to be the debut of a new segment called What's in Justin's Head. Justin is going to basically call here and give me some sort of random thought in his head, and I'm going to react to that. It should be interesting. We'll see. This is the debut of a new segment here on Carson's Corner. We're glad that Justin's out and about. He's always been a very, very good friend of the show. And him and I did a YouTube video last week. And it was probably earlier on in the week. And he just called me, and I was lying in bed. I did this YouTube video. You could actually see it on his YouTube page at youtube.com/ Frank Dukes friend, or Frank Dukes fan, and it's just me, and I just I'm just laying down. I just look a mess. I'm just, you know, it's really kind of comical, to be honest with you. But yeah, so he's going to be calling us a little later on in the program, and we have not a lot going on. Just I want to talk about this poll that came out. Quinnipiac University, which they provide very valuable polls. Okay, they're it's not like Gallup or some of these other polling companies that really have discredited themselves with the 2012 election. I mean, you had some of these polling companies saying that Mitt Romney was going to win. You had Gallup having Mitt Romney ahead when Mitt Romney was really never ahead, was never going to win this election. Really wasn't that close of an election if you looked at the electoral map. But yet certain polling companies just really have become politicized, and they don't produce reliable polls. And you know, we see this. But Quinnipiac has been a pretty, pretty good source of polling data for the American people. And they just did this poll where it revealed that 44% of Republicans think that an armed revolution is possible. And I believe I have to get the wording of the polling, the poll results, but something to the effect that 44% of Republicans think that an armed rebellion against the government is necessary and is likely to happen. Okay, I don't know if it's necessary or likely to happen, but the reason why this is important, because it shows the political landscape that we have here in America. And this is something that I've been saying since 2008. I mean, literally, I've been talking about this for over 5 years now, okay? We have just a crazy political landscape out there where you basically have conspiracy theorists running the show within the Republican Party. You have a bad economy where we have 12 million people that are out of work. You have a real fear and paranoia that the government is going to somehow take away people's guns. And this is, it's really the basis of this is fear and uncertainty, I think. Economic fear and uncertainty. We have vast wealth and income consolidation in America. The top 1% of income earners earn 24% of the income. They have 50% of the country's wealth. I've seen estimates that say that the top 1% has 90% of the aggregate assets in this country. And that is really producing a toxic political climate in this country. And so, you know, people are afraid, particularly white Americans are afraid. They're paranoid, and they're tuning into cult-like figures like Glenn Beck and Alex Jones, and these guys are just pumping them full of paranoia and misinformation and fear and whatnot, because if you keep these people fearful, if you keep them paranoid, then they're likely to act, they're likely to consume. And this has really, really just gotten worse over the past 5 years. It's not getting any better. And, you know, the Republican Party, which really has had some soul searching after both presidential elections. I mean, the same thing happened after 2008, where John McCain was he was bashed, and he wasn't considered a real conservative, and so on and so forth. And you know, all the Republicans have to do is just stick to their base and stick to their, quote, principles, and so on and so forth. And somehow they're going to win presidential elections, and they're going to win Senate races and this and that. And after 2012, the same discussion took place. And what always ends up happening is that the Republican Party just further and further and further gets or becomes more controlled by their lunatic conspiracy theory base. And this is, you know, reflected in this new Quinnipiac poll where you have 44% of the American or Republicans think that an armed rebellion against the government may be coming soon. Now, let me ask you something. What would happen if they pulled the Tea Party? Okay, the most extreme members of the electorate. What would happen? What would the polls indicate? You'd probably see something like 80% or 90% of Tea Party people think that a rebellion against the government is necessary. You have, in 2010, 25% of the Tea Party thinking attacks against political violence against the government is necessary. This has gotten worse, and these people have gotten more and more extreme. And then, you know, you look at what that does to the political process. I was talking about the corporate media at the beginning of the show, how the corporate media is just interested in sensationalism and interested in getting ratings. And this, because you have such an extreme Republican Party, you have conspiracy theorists, people believing in what Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh say, and you have extreme representatives like Ted Cruz and these other Tea Party people who can't even vote for a simple background check. The mainstream media has to do their typical, oh, both sides. Well, both sides, they have to draw some sort of equivalency between what the Republicans do and what the Democrats do. And they can't just say, listen, we have one side in this country that is completely insane. We have a group of white Americans that believe in conspiracy theories or are fearful and are being stoked by right-wing talk radio and Fox News. And then we have the other half of this equation that, you know, generally tries to get more information, generally tries to understand issues, and, you know, they're not believing in conspiracy theories. They just want solutions to the problems that face us. And what's happened is that the whole political discussion goes further and further and further to crazy land that we can't get anything done in this country. And this is not an accident. You know, what's happening with the Republican Party is not some sort of an accident. It's not just the way it goes. It's part of an orchestrated effort by business interests, libertarian business interests, the Koch brothers, you know, Anschewitz. You could look at a whole line of libertarian right-wing billionaires that stand to benefit from all of this polarization. Okay, I'm reading a book now by Li Fong, and it's very, very good. He really details the right-wing machine out there. It's called The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, and it's by Li Fong. And he talks about how these groups organize. He talks about how they launch campaigns, and they've essentially taken control over the Republican Party. And this is just—it's really, really unfortunate because nothing can get done right now. You know, you have a United States Congress that, even with the high unemployment rate, again, 7.5% of the population, of the working population, is unemployed. You can argue whether or not that number is real. You know, you can argue that there's more, that there's probably more, but that's the official unemployment rate that's put out there, I believe, by the Bureau of Labor, or the Labor Bureau. And none of the politicians in Washington, D.C. are concerned at all over the unemployed. In fact, for the past 5 years, we've had no regard for the unemployed out there. There just hasn't been anything. You know, Wall Street had its collapse in 2008, and our elected officials rushed to give trillions of dollars to the banking industry, and at the same time they resisted a bailout for the homeowners out there. So what does that tell you? You know, who are these people working for? Not you and I. They're working for the very corporate interests that have strangled our political system in America. And, you know, it's only going to get worse. It really is, because the Republican Party is not going to change. The Democratic Party is just only further going to mirror the interests of big business. And we're just seeing this, and we have seen this over the last 30-plus years. People like President Obama and other Democrats are only slightly less oppressive to the working folk of America. They don't have our interests at heart. They're serving the interests of big business. And if they could do, you know, some piecemeal legislation that may benefit you and I, then that's great. But that's not their first priority. Their first priority is taking care of Wall Street. Their first priority is taking care of big business, because they continue to center the economy around big business and not give a damn about you and I. And that really is reflective of the fact that, you know, our Congress doesn't even care about the unemployed anymore. Recently in Washington, D.C., the Senate had a hearing on unemployment, and only a couple senators actually went to this hearing. It's really unbelievable. It really is. But the good news is, if you look at the long-term demographics of America and you look at what's changing, they're not going to be able to get away with this anytime soon. The demographics just bear that out. If you look at a state like Arizona, for example, Arizona has almost half of the school population, half of the kids that are going to school in Arizona are Hispanic. In Texas, there's some talk about Texas becoming a blue state in the near future. I think that's entirely possible. You know, you look at states like Colorado, New Mexico, these states that are crucial in elections, they're becoming more and more diverse. And that's happening to the American population as a whole. And that's a good thing, because if the Republican Party and both parties have to answer to a more diverse electorate, then we're more likely to get things done. You know, right now the Republican Party and the right-wing media machine can just cater to white, older, paranoid individuals. They could just cater to the Fox crowd, the NRA crowd. And they could potentially still win elections, because there's enough white, older, working-class people out there that are resentful against immigrants, resentful against minorities, to keep these people in power. So they don't have to really reach out. They just have to, quote, you know, recalibrate their message. They don't care. But that's changing. And pretty soon, these people who want to stay in power are going to have to do the bidding of the American people in order to stay in power. It's just the natural progression of things. It's the way this country is going. Once you have a minority white population, I believe, then we're going to have more democracy out there. We're going to have democracy in the workplace. We're going to have a fair taxation system in America. We're going to have a fair distribution system in America. And it's going to take time. It really is. I'm not one of these people that believes that, you know, oh, look, we can just eradicate or get rid of the Constitution, get rid of both parties and start over, and somehow, you know, it's going to be a utopian world. I'm not one of these people that believes that, because we have to have some power structure in America to survive. If we abolish the government, like people, libertarians, suggest, and even some in the Zeitgeist movement, which I support generally, suggest, then you're going to have some sort of power structure that moves in its place, and it's going to control us. So I'm not, you know, we could spend 2 hours talking about the problems with capitalism and all these other things, whether we have a value system disorder, whether we have this and that. But at the end of the day, no economic system is going to be perfect, and we have to realize that. So we really should take the existing system and make it better and take control over everything and make our economy work for us, not just the top 1%. Now, I realize that those in the Zeitgeist movement are probably cringing at me saying this, and I can understand that, but this is the reality. It really is. You know, after World War II, when we had a much higher rate of taxation, and we had almost a truce between labor and capital, although the passage of Taft-Hartley, many people feel that that marked the beginning of the end for labor unions in America. There wasn't this idea of greed is good in America. There wasn't this idea of someone like, you know, Mitt Romney, who's just a disgusting human being and just the absolute worst among us, could be a president in this country. It was a much different society. And what we've seen after World War II is sustained economic growth to everybody, not just the top 1%. After the New Deal reforms were put in place from 1947 until 1980, roughly, we had, you know, an average of 3% GDP growth. We had upwards mobility in America. We had a high rate of unionization compared to how it's been for the past 30 years. And you didn't have the social problems that we have now. You didn't have half of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. You didn't have 3 million Americans incarcerated. You didn't have the highest rate of childhood poverty. The 22 homeless people for every house available, or 22 houses for every homeless person available. You didn't have massive income and wealth consolidation. And, you know, I think we should strive towards a more democratic, socialist country. That's what I think we should do. I think we should strive to be like Germany, for example, in some areas. Germany, you know, half of the workforce, if you want to form a corporation in Germany, half of the workforce is comprised of workers. In Germany, if you get laid off, this is from my understanding, okay? If you get laid off, or you know, you're an employer and you have to lay off your workers, there's a program called Kurzbar, which the government will basically subsidize you. The government will, you know, pay you 10% of what your employees make, so this way you don't have to. You could cut your employees' hours, but you could still pay them full time because the government will subsidize you. And, you know, they also have programs in Germany where, God forbid, if you're sick, you're in a hospital, you have to have some sort of surgery, the government will actually give you money. They'll pay you up to 3/4 of what you were making at your job, and they have universal health care in Germany. So why aren't we doing that here? Why is it that, you know, we have such a disdain for anybody that receives government assistance, even though, you know, the vast majority of welfare in America is going to the defense industry, is going to the banking industry, is going to people like Mitt Romney? Why is it that here in the United States we can't even fund our government? We have to implement austerity measures that hurt everybody. You know, you look at what happened with the FAA, where because rich white people are traveling and have to fly to work and have to fly all across the country, they don't want to be inexperienced. So we're going to fund the FAA to make sure that traffic controllers are put in place, and therefore there's no delay, and rich people can travel just as they do normally. They don't have to be inconvenienced. What does that tell you about who has the power in Washington, D.C.? Do you see any efforts to restore the Meals on Wheels that are that have been cut because of the sequester? Do you see any efforts to restore some of the treatment for cancer patients? Do you see any other efforts to deal with any of the children that were kicked off of Head Start? No, of course not, because these individuals do not have political power in our country. The only thing that matters to our politicians is money, is essentially money. Money equals power. And so, you know, there's no money in providing Head Start for somebody or a program. There's no money in, you know, Meals on Wheels. No billionaires behind it. No business interest is going to make money. No Wall Street hedge fund manager is going to really be able to make, you know, $1 billion off of that. On the other hand, you look at all the business opportunities in America. Look at why is there a push to privatize our schools. And by the way, President Obama has really increased the privatization of our schools. Why is there a push to privatize Social Security? Why is there a push to privatize our roads, privatize our police forces, our, you know, fire departments, fill in the blank? Because there's money to be made from that. There's a business interest. There's some Mitt Romney out there that stands to make money from the privatization of our services, the privatization of our resources. There's huge money, so there's always going to be political will where the money is. You're always going to have political will. And that leads me to a very good article that I found on the Daily Coast, and it talks about socialism. And I want to just let the American people know this, because you don't hear about this on the corporate media, which is why you shouldn't watch the corporate media, okay? The corporate media treats socialism as a dirty word, and it doesn't even enter into the equation, okay? Socialism, or any type of economic system that does not serve the interests of the very wealthy, is ruled out by default in our corporate media, right? And most people don't understand this because they take it for granted. But to a large extent, the United States of America is a socialist country. And socialism improves all of our lives. It does, in ways that certainly Tea Party people out there can't understand. Let me give you an example. Actually, I'm going to pull it up right now, but the name of the article is, just bear with me one second here. I'm going to pull it up here. The 75 ways socialism has improved America. Now, you hear these Republicans talk about, oh, the government is this, the government is that, the government needs to be smaller, whatever the hell that means, right? The government is the problem. Ronald Reagan said the government is not the solution. Government is the problem, which is just laughable. But there are people out there that, again, listen to right-wing talk radio and Fox News and are being bamboozled into thinking that the government is bad and the government is evil and this and that. But there's not a person in America that doesn't depend on the United States government. We all depend on the United States government, and we all enjoy the services that we receive from the United States government. I mean, just if you walk out of your house, you're depending on the United States government. You have an expectation that the air is going to be clean. You have an expectation that the roads are going to be safe. You have an expectation that there's going to be no drunk driver out there that's going to, you know, be driving on the wrong side of the road. You have an expectation that no standing army or no terrorist is going to blow you up. And if you don't have that expectation, you expect that there's somebody out there to prevent that. You have an expectation when you deposit your money that it's going to be insured. You have an expectation that, you know, if God forbid you have to call the police, you have to call the firefighters, they're going to be there. You have an expectation that when you go to a beach, there's a lifeguard there. Well, guess what? These are all government services that exist to everybody. It's a form of socialism. These are the socialist ways that America, that has been, you know, improve America. These are areas of socialism. And, you know, look, if you want to privatize these programs, you want to privatize the police department, you want to privatize the fire departments, this and that, well, guess what? These services evaporate because the private sector is about money. The only thing, the only reason why people create a business in America is to make money. That's it. And the way for them to make money is to be inherently inefficient and rule or act against sustainability. Sustainability is the enemy. Sustainability and efficiency are the enemy, the enemies of the private sector. Peter Joseph talks about this a lot in his Zeitgeist films, and that's absolutely correct. The private sector, you know, a businessman exists because he sells products to people over the course of a lifetime, okay? And if he were to sell a product to somebody and have that product exist for the rest of his life, then his job would be harder because he'd have to sell products to many other people, and it would be that much harder for him to remain in business. But yet if he sells a product to somebody and that product is going to break down in 2 or 3 years, just, you know, whether it's because of mechanical issues, it's whether it's because of the way it was designed, or that product becomes less valuable as time goes on, well, then that customer has to go back to that business man and buy more of his product. And that's what the market system is all about. Our market system in America is based on inefficiency, okay? Now, you look at government services, as we were talking about, you look at socialism. Socialism is based on efficiency. It's not based on inefficiency. Medicare is a pretty good idea of socialism. You know, Medicare, you pay into Medicare, right? You pay payroll taxes into this program. And when you retire, you could die before you hit the age of retirement, or you could live to your 100 years old. Regardless of what you paid into the system, you get benefits. And that is a single-payer system, essentially. That's what socialism is, okay? And it's not based on inefficiency because there's no overhead. There's no CEO in Medicare making, you know, $100 million. There's no shareholders making money. It's not like United Healthcare where they have, you know, God knows how many millionaires in United Healthcare. They have their CEOs making billions of dollars, William J. Helmsley. Stephen J. Helmsley, William McGuire, $1.7 billion William McGuire made, dollar Bill McGuire over a course of a few years. It's unbelievable. But this is, you know, this is what happens. This is, you know, this is what our system looks like now, okay? And the government does not have to make a profit. The government just has to. And I'm not saying the government's perfect. I mean, don't get me wrong. But the government does not have to make a profit. The government has to administer services to people. They have to do what's in the public's best interest, right? Supposedly. And doing the right thing in America, being altruistic, is threatening to the business interests of this country. I mean, it just is. You know, the notion that the government has to protect and serve the people, and the government has to administer services that are in keeping with the general welfare of the American people, is threatening to our market system. Because if more and more people experience government services, if more and more people realize, hey, wait a minute, you know, the government does have a role, and there shouldn't be privatization, there shouldn't be a profit motive when it comes to healthcare, there shouldn't be a profit motive when it comes to, you know, basic needs like water and the resources that we use to sustain life. If people realize that, then people would reject the notion of having private for-profit insurance companies. People would reject the privatization of our resources because it's contradictory to human life. And that's the point. And that's why, you know, the areas of socialism in our economy are under attack because they're a threat to somebody's business interest. They're a threat to someone's bottom line, you know? And that's what, you know, but we are a socialist country in many, many respects. And I would argue that our socialism, to the extent that we have it here in America, it is being under attack by the very wealthy, is really what makes America great. What makes America great is that we have a Social Security system where somebody, you know, God forbid, if they were in a horrible accident and they lost their husband or they lost their, you know, fill in the blank, or they're of, you know, they're of limited physical capacity, they can't work and whatnot, they get Social Security. They may not have paid into it, but they will still get Social Security. And that's a great program, and that's a great value decision because we have said that, you know, we're better than this. We're going to provide a minimum level of support for people out there that genuinely need the support. And so therefore, you know, you'll have a chance to live even if you can't go out there and make money. That's what makes this country great. Look at Veterans Administration, the most popular health care system in America, the best. VA care is the absolute best. The technology within the Veterans Administration is phenomenal. You know, our veterans have the access. It's socialized medicine. It's government-run hospitals, government-run government doctors. You know, there's no room for the private market because it's about giving a service back to our veterans, our seniors, or whatever. That's what it's all about. That's what makes this country great. The fact that we have public libraries. You know, some poor kid in the city can go and study at a public library and fill himself with knowledge and at least give himself a chance, even if he can't go to college. That's what makes this country great. Police departments. You don't have a dime in your bank account. You need help. Somebody's breaking into your house or somebody's doing this or doing that. You get to call the police department. And regardless of your ability to pay, you're going to get a service from a police officer who's putting his or her life on the line to serve the public. Do you see how these things are threatening to Wall Street? Do you see how this is threatening to the business interests that rule this country? Because if we start to have a certain level of expectation out there, if we start to say, you know what, I'm sorry, I reject the notion that there's a private company controlling my energy. I reject the notion that there's a private company controlling my health care. I reject the notion that, you know, I can go on and on and on. Then we start to have society move towards a more equal society. And that is wrong. That is threatening to the business interests out there. And that's the bottom line, you know. And so we really have to look at this. I mean, just everything. Everything that's great about America comes from socialism. Public schools, another example. You know, you can't afford to send your kids to school. Guess what? You have the option of sending your kid to a public school. Public schools have to take anybody out there, whether you're rich, poor, handicapped, you know, whatever your socioeconomic status is, a public school has to take you, depending upon where you live. And everybody gets to go to school, all different races, all different sexualities, all different whatever. They get to go to public school. And you know what? There's an effort to privatize our school systems out there. There is. But these are all ways that our country is better. And these are all under attack. Let me tell you something, folks. My friend Ralph Nader talks about this. He's been talking about this probably longer than I've been alive. Same thing with people like Bill Moyers and others out there. The countervailing institutions of America, the institutions that are supposed to protect the people and promote the general welfare of this country, are all under attack. Everything. We talked about unions. Under attack. It's practically illegal in America to unionize. These right-to-work states wiping out unions, making it virtually illegal to unionize. Ensuring that workers in the workplace do not have a share in democracy. Capital controls their life. The business interest that the owner has of the is more important than the welfare of that employee. Regulatory agencies, these very agencies I was talking about, under attack, being gutted. Because these regulatory agencies, what do? They're responsible for regulating corporate America. And corporate America doesn't want to be regulated. They want to run wild as they've done really for the last 30 years. But there's no limit to their freedom. There's no limit to their freedom because the more that they're free, the more money that they make. And corporations are monsters trying to devour as much profit as they can. They don't care about human life. They don't have to. They're not supposed to. And they're run by people that are sociopaths. You have to be a sociopath to be a Wall Street CEO or Wall Street trader. You have to be a sociopath to make 500 times your lowest paid worker. But that's what we have in America. Consumer advocacy groups, non-existent anymore. Who's writing our laws in Washington, D.C.? You think it's some consumer advocacy group that's interested in, you know, saving humans? Or you think it's some animal group looking to protect animals from the business interests of America? Nope, absolutely not. They're non-existent anymore, consumer advocacy groups. I mean, we are just marching further and further and further towards fascism. And pretty soon in America, I mean, you know, these corporations, it's already happening. These corporations are owning police cars. They're going to start buying police departments. They're going to start buying fire hydrants. It's already happening, as I've said. They're going to start buying streets, buying everything they can get their greedy goddamn hands on, and they're going to suck the life out of you and I. If a corporation can capture the air and charge people for breathing, they would. They don't care. And they have to be controlled. These corporations and these CEOs and the very wealthy, they have to be controlled. They have to be marginalized. They have to be, you know, separate from us. The government has to protect us. You know, one caller to the Tom Hartman show challenged Tom. And by the way, Tom is I'm a big fan of Tom Hartman. I encourage you to subscribe to his podcast and read his books. I mean, you know, Tom's a little bit too friendly to the Obama administration, and he's a little bit too involved, I think, in the Democratic Party. But nonetheless, he's a scholar, and he handles these people brilliantly. And he's an independent guy in the sense that he owns his own show. I don't think you're going to see Tom Hartman on MSNBC, which is what I'm going to discuss the demise of MSNBC. But Tom Hartman had a caller the other day and said, how big government should be? How big do you think progressive, or how big should government be according to you progressives out there? And you know what Tom said? He actually said this on a later show. He said, I want the government big enough to protect me from corporate America. I want the government big enough to regulate Wall Street. I want government big enough to regulate the oil companies that are spilling their product and destroying our land and destroying our oceans. I want the government big enough to put these Wall Street CEOs and Wall Street sociopaths and people like Mitt Romney in jail. I want the government big enough to collect taxes from these same corporations that are advertising to us while shipping our jobs overseas. I want the government big enough. I mean, you know, this is what the government has to do. But right now the government is not big enough to do that because the government is being strangled by the private sector. Private sector, privatization equals more corporate control. So just remember that. Whenever you hear one of these right-wing people on Fox News, or you know one of these right-wing white individuals, because they're virtually all white in America, whenever you hear them talk about privatization, understand that that means more corporate control. Whenever you hear them talk about freedom, understand that what they're talking about is the freedom of the money sequence, the freedom of money to move all around without any type of hurdles, even if that's around your neck. Understand that. Because that's what they're talking about. That's what they've been conditioned to talk about. Okay? So I encourage you to go to Daily Kos and read this this very, very lengthy article about how socialism has improved America. And so the way I see it is we need more socialism. We need more socialism in America. I'm not saying we have to overthrow capitalism. No, nobody's saying that. I'm not a communist. Communism doesn't work, in my opinion. I know there are a lot of people out there that will disagree, or some people. There's not that many communists in America. You know, it's not the days of 1950s or whatever. But the reality is, as John Perkins says, the current form of capitalism is not working for America. And that is just obvious. It is. And that's what's hurting us. All right, we were talking a moment ago about I got distracted there. We actually have a caller on the phone. We're going to get a quick call. I don't have too much time. I think this may be my friend here. You're on with Bob Carson.
Hello, Mr. Carson. How are you this afternoon?
Good.
Excellent. I find it very interesting that you think that socialism is a workable conception. All we have to do is go back and look at Jamestown. and it was not. And it was just recently discovered that there was designated cannibalism in Jamestown because that was based upon a socialist model. Everybody is supposed to pitch in and do their fair share. Is that not correct? And
no,
it didn't work out quite well for them.
I'm not talking about I'm not talking about not having a private sector in America. I'm not talking about totally eliminating the business sector in this country. I'm talking about more democratic socialism in America. I'm talking about more government services that we know works for the American people and less privatization.
Let me ask you this, sir. If you're basing it on going to the particular, it's called the DMV in my area, the Department of Motor Vehicles, that is so efficiently ran, is it not? And any of the 50 states, or if, you know, under Obama's 57 states,
you said they
or going to the post office,
Hold on. You said that they were inefficiently run?
If you're looking at customer service.
I'll tell you what, though. I'll tell you what. My DMV here in New Jersey, there was a problem in New Jersey, and it's a very, very complicated situation. It has a lot to do with a lack of funding. You know, states have been impacted by a lack of funding at the federal level, but my DMV in New Jersey has really revamped itself. And now I can go into a DMV, and granted, sometimes the lines are long, sometimes they're not. But it is really, they've really increased their services here for the general public. In fact, I think it was Christy Todd Whitman actually revamped the DMV in New Jersey. Now, if you want to privatize the DMV, if you want to put a private company in the DMV, what's going to happen is you're going to pay more for licenses. You're going to pay more to register your car.
Let me stop. Did I say one word about privatizing?
Sure.
No, I didn't.
Well, suggesting that the government can't do anything right. You're saying that the government is inefficient, and then you throw out the post office. Let me tell you something. People go to the post office because they want to mail something across the country for, you know, 45 cents. They don't want to go to FedEx. They don't want to go to UPS. If they choose to do that, they're going to pay more, and that's fine. People have the right to do that. But the post office, one of the reasons why they stopped. They were going to shut down all these post offices on Saturday. They were going to stop the Saturday delivery. Well, no, they didn't do that because people need the post office to deliver mail all across America. And I'll tell you something. What's your name, by the way?
No, my name is Blue, like the color B-L-U-E.
Oh, good.
What I'm getting at when it comes to government employees.
Let me just make one more point. Then I'm going to go to you, and then I'm going to have to go to our guest here. The post office subsidizes FedEx and UPS because FedEx and UPS cannot deliver all across America without making a profit. They have to pay their CEOs. They have to pay their shareholders. So the post office, so what do they do? They'll need to go deliver a package to some place down south where they don't have a FedEx distribution center, and they'll give it to the post office, and the post office will mail it there. So that's an example of how the government does work. Is the post office perfect? Could it be competing more with the private sector? Yes, but the post office has restrictions because of a 2006 George W. Bush bill, a poison pill piece of legislation that was designed to defund the post office. I'm going to allow you to make one more point, please go.
Well, it's a typical liberal programming when you're afraid to listen to what I have to say, but that's okay.
Hello?
Hello?
Go ahead, yeah. You're on the air. Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. It's typical for you to push off someone that is not in conjunction with your... I think you're more libertarian than you are progressive.
To some part, yes. When it comes to personal behavior, I'm somewhat of a libertarian, yes. But no, I don't have a problem. Listen, you could call... I'm on a tight break here. You could call any time, and we could have it. You know, I've had conservatives on this program for entire hours. It's not that I'm not interested in what you're saying. I was just correcting. You were saying some things about the post office and the DMV, and I can't allow certain stuff to take place over there. I have to correct people, but go ahead.
My point was, the laziest people that I have ever seen are those that work for the federal government. Mm-hmm. The second laziest people that I've ever seen have worked for state government. Now, I come from a state that is a right-to-work state.
Mm-hmm.
In my particular state, we have no debt. And my particular city that I live in, which is in Tennessee, we have zero debt. And we actually have a surplus. And we're a right-to-work state.
Well,
we have no income tax in the state of Tennessee. Period.
But Tennessee also accepts more money from the government for every
dollar. Oh no, we do. We are a donor state. Shut your mouth, boy. Shut your mouth.
I'm gonna hang up on you now. Now you're getting belligerent. See, the right wingers can't handle facts, and then they resort to personal attacks against me. I would have had that lady on for a longer period of time, but they get belligerent. And what happens with states in the South, okay, look at states in the South. They get more money back from the federal government than they give in. Blue states in America, right, non-right-to-work states that allow workers to unionize, have a strong public sector. For every dollar that they give, that the government collects in taxes for them, I'm getting mixed up here. The blue states give $1.50 or something to that effect more to the government than the government gives to that state in services. And that's the bottom line. Blue states are more efficient. Most of the poverty in America is down south. And she talks about Tennessee. Let me tell you something. You compare the wages to workers in Tennessee to workers in California. California has one of the largest economies in the world. Compare the wages to workers of New York, New York City, New Jersey, and you're going to see it's night and day. It really is. And so the true welfare states in America, the true welfare recipients, are the very people that just called here. Now, we have Justin Harvey on the program. We're going to get to him, but I just want to talk about MSNBC because I wrote it down in my notes here, and I got to tell you what's happening with MSNBC. It's an absolute joke. It really is, because as I've said on MSNBC, their ratings are crumbling. When Ed Schultz was part of the lineup there, and believe me, I've criticized Ed Schultz. I will. I'll continue to criticize him for a lot of different reasons. But, you know, Ed is a broadcaster. Ed is a personality. Ed has passion, okay? And he's kind of cleaned his act up. He's kind of been a little bit more careful in terms of being outspoken ever since he called Laura Ingraham a whore, or called her a talk slut, a talk radio slut, which, I have no problem with that. I would actually call her a corporate whore. But anyway, they have gone down significantly in the ratings. And that's because what MSNBC is doing is they have had people that are not hosts, wonks, geeks, nerds, right? People like, I want to say, Ezra Klein, who Ezra Klein is not a broadcaster. He's not a personality. He's a writer for the Washington Post, and he just studies numbers, okay? And then you've got someone like Chris Hayes, who I've actually interviewed Chris Hayes. He used to respond to my emails, and I understand he's probably busy now. He's a decent guy, but you know, he's not what progressives need are people like Mike Papantonio. If you're not familiar with him, you can go to ringoffire.com, ringoffireradio.com, I believe is his website, and you could just listen to his commentary. No holds barred. He's not worried about offending anybody, and that's what we need. We need people out there that are going to fight for workers and fight against the very wealthy and capitalism in its current form. You don't need these geeks and these nerds and these wonks and this and that on MSNBC. So if MSNBC is listening, they'll take my advice. But don't forget, MSNBC is essentially, I believe, owned by Comcast. In 2010, there was a merger between Comcast and General Electric. And Comcast is a very conservative company. Many of the high-level officials at Comcast are known right-wingers, and Comcast at one point was a business partner to the Tea Party. So that has to do with it, too. That could have something to do with the just mess at MSNBC. They're not listening. They're not putting workers on. You need someone like Leo Gerard or someone like Richard Trumka. You need that tone and that passion. You could say what you want about Fox News, and I do. There are a bunch of corporate hacks on Fox News. They're bought and paid for by the Chamber of Commerce. Someone like Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, whatever, they're paid spokespeople. They're posing as human beings to try to get people to accept an agenda that benefits them and nobody else. These guys are hosts. They're hosts. They have personalities, and they have broadcasting experience. At least Sean Clannity does. And I call him Clannity because his obvious admiration for people like George Zimmerman and Mark Furman and a whole list of other white men who have been criticized for being racist. It seems that Fox News, there's a home for a bigotry on Fox News. I can go on and on and on. All right, I'm starting to get fired up here. Okay, I'm getting fired up, and you know what? We have a guest on the program right now. Justin Ray Harvey is back. I'm telling you, Justin's great. I'm talking to him every day. He's pumped up. He's ready to go. He's going to start recording. He's going to start doing his own show. He's got a lot going on. And this is the debut of What's in Justin's Head. Let's find out. What's in Justin's Head?
Hey, Bob. How's it going, brother?
Not much, man. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Before I get to what's in my head, I have a few statements that I would like to make, if you don't mind.
The floor is yours, my friend.
Okay. First of all, I want everybody to know, if you call the program, please, please do not use Skype because it drops Bob's show. It messes up the show. So if you want to call with your opinions, your subjects, please dial the phone number and call the show. And
yes,
I was going to tell you too, Bob, that the reason I called in early is because I'm in the chat room and the Blog Talk Radio player kept stopping, and I'd have to restart it, and there would be some sort of delay. So it's a BTR glitch, of course.
I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that we don't have any problems throughout this show. I have to go back, because I don't know. When I'm on the air, I don't know if there's any type of technical problems. If I don't receive any pop-ups or anything from Blog Talk saying that I lost connection or whatnot, I just continue on the show. So I hope that I don't have any problems with the audio with this one, because this is a pretty good show. I mean, we've already been on over an hour here, and we still have about over 20 minutes to go.
And the last two comments before I get to my main topic, what's in Justin's head, I'd like to say one of the main reasons I love our show, Bob, is regardless of what somebody says or thinks, whether they're, you know, a right winger, whatever they have to say, we let them speak their piece.
I do, and with that lady that called earlier, she called on Skype, so I hope she didn't screw up this show. But what I can't allow misinformation to take place on this show. I can't allow someone to call here and just, you know, because what you see on right-wing talk radio, if you watch Fox News, and this is why I don't watch it, there was a time where I used to listen to right-wing radio, and I stopped doing it because the amount of misinformation that people like that can just spout off is just unbelievable. And if you let them go for, you know, 15, 20 seconds, you have 15 or 20 lies or bits of misinformation that you have to really address. And Mm-hmm. So she was talking about, you know, the DMVs, and she's talking about how inefficient, you know, the government is, this and that. And she says, oh, everybody that I know in the public sector is lazy, and they're the laziest people. It is a typical indoctrination of a person that does not have information. You want to talk about teachers. Teachers are state workers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Teachers, yeah, on average, work more hours when you combine some of the stuff they do off clock, grading tests, reports, than anybody in the private sector. And teachers have more education than the average worker in the private sector, and they work, you know, almost, you know, they make less money and they work, you know, twice as hard. I mean, to make a comment that, you know, that the laziest people I know are state workers, it just shows you that she, you know, doesn't have a good grasp of what the problem is. And unfortunately, she's buying into this right-wing meme that we just have to, if we could just get rid of the public sector unions, then all of us will prosper. Well, guess what? If we could just bring up the private sector unions, if we have unionization in the private sector, if we gave workers the right to collectively bargain, then the private sector, you'd have better wages in the private sector. See, what happens is, and I just got to comment on this because it's a very important topic that we're talking about here, is that the business interests I've been railing against the whole show, they stand to benefit when there's no unions, okay? Now, you look at the private sector in America, most of the unionization is in the private sector. You have probably about a third of private sector or public sector workers that are unionized, okay? I don't know if I just said private sector, but about a third of the public sector workers are unionized. Everybody wants a public sector job. Everybody wants to become a police officer. They want to become a firefighter. They want to join the post office. Why? Because they actually have benefits. They actually have collective bargaining. They actually have certain rights that the private sector does not have. And so the public sector is a threat to the business interests out there because they're unionized. And so what do? Let's go after the public sector union. Let's go after that teacher. And to my knowledge, there's no teacher on the Fortune 400 richest Americans list. Let's go after the public sector worker because we've got the private sector working for Burger King wages. And they got people like this who unfortunately do not have a lot of information and are absorbing right-wing talk radio and Fox News. They get them, and they have them under their control, and they get them to do the bidding of the business interests of America. Let me tell you something. Workers need to be unionized in both the public and private sector, okay? And the idea that we're going to sit there and criticize public sector workers is really laughable, but it's not, because the business interests that are pushing this propaganda out there, they have a tremendous amount of power in our country, and unfortunately, public sectors have been attacked because they have, a democracy in the workplace, and that's something that corporations do not want. The very wealthy and the business interests of America, they do not want there to be democracy. I mean, I can only imagine if I had the right to collective bargain, if I had any type of voice in my workplace, how much that it would interfere with their profits. And it's just disgusting. It's people like that unfortunately slow up the debate here. I'll have a discussion with anybody. I don't care. You know, I am confident in my knowledge to debate anybody in the world. And they're welcome to call on this, call me anytime they want to. I don't screen any phone calls. You can, in the chat room, anybody's welcome in the chat room. That's fine, because I'm confident in my knowledge, and I'm confident in what's going to turn this country around. So, you know, thank you very much. And yeah, that's key. We don't mind talking to anybody out there, but once you start telling me to shut up or shut my mouth, that's going to be it. I would advise you, Miss, whoever you are, Bluebird in Tennessee, listen to my show and learn and take notes. When you listen to me, you take notes and you educate yourself. Okay, Justin.
And don't be hating on Bob either. Bob is what makes America great. So.
You too, Justin, man. I'm so proud of you. You're really getting back in the swing of things.
Yes, thank you, Bob. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for What's in Justin's Head. Well, here's what's been in my head for a while, Bob, and I want to get your thoughts on it.
Yes.
This is a big problem in our country and other countries, which we don't really discuss. Animal cruelty. What should be the punishment for animal cruelty? Should it be, like, depending on the offense, should current owners have a license, have to have a license after they've, you know, mistreated their animals, or let's say they've killed their animal? Should they have to face the death penalty, life in prison if they kill their animal? I want your thoughts on this, because this is a very, very good topic.
Yes, it is. Oh, it's a brilliant topic, and I'm already enjoying this segment already. This is brilliant. This is thought provoking. Wow. Well, first of all, I believe that, you know, in depending upon what you do to an animal, you should be fined and you should be thrown in jail. I mean, animals. I'll tell you, I know people out there. And I hate to make anecdotal arguments, but I'm just going to throw this out there. I know people out there that would probably kill a person to protect an animal. And that's fine. You know, I love dogs. I love cats. So I don't want to see anything happen to them. There should be, and there is, there's laws against animal cruelty on the books at the state level. There's fines, and I guess depending upon the degree of what happened, you could even serve jail time. And as for repeat offenders, someone that has been, you know, convicted of animal cruelty for, you know, on many occasions, they probably, I would imagine, that as part of their sentencing, they probably wouldn't be able to own an animal. You know, it probably would be illegal for them to even own an animal. It probably would violate their parole. And, you know, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with, as you said, issuing licenses, make people, you know, demonstrate people that have had a conviction for animal cruelty, make them demonstrate the ability to be around animals and not hurt them is fine. Or maybe even create a registry. You know how they have a registered sex offenders list?
Yeah, that was going to be my next point. Make them register, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it has to be like, I want to talk about like physical abuse of animals because, you know, there have been cases, and I'm sure you don't want to make it too black and white. You want to make like, you know, if somebody is at work, I'll give you an example. My boss, okay,
mm-hmm.
He's actually getting rid of his dog because he can't spend enough time with his dog. He just got a new promotion and the dog is left alone for hours in his apartment and he can't have that. Now, someone like that who, because of their work schedule and because of the circumstances in their life, they may be charged with some sort of animal cruelty or charged with some sort of neglect. I don't know. You never know the circumstances. You know, a neighbor could report him and say, listen, he's locking his dog up all day, and you can have, you know, whichever authority comes and investigates, and he could be given a summons or he can be given a fine, when in actuality he's trying to care for a pet. He just can't mm-hmm. do so because, you know, his circumstances in his life. I don't want to see that person on a list, a animal cruelty list. On the other hand, if you have somebody, an adult who unfortunately gets off on torturing animals, has a history of torturing animals, then I have no problem with exposing them, putting him on a list and shaming him for what he's done.
Yeah, exactly, because this case to me is very sentimental because I have a German Shepherd, and she's very loyal. She anywhere I go, Bob, in the house, it doesn't matter. She's right there and very protective of me. Now, how can somebody be abusive to their animals and neglect their animals? And it's just, you know, just because they cannot speak in our language doesn't make it right.
I love, yeah, that's right. I love dogs. My favorite dog is the Lab. I'm a big fan of Labradors, and I've studied them in the past, and they're great animals. And you're absolutely right. And what was I going to say? I had a point that I was going to make, but it just slipped my mind. But you know, we have a responsibility to look out for animals. And here's another thing too that really it could just further, I think, protect animals. Okay, if you have someone that has demonstrated reckless behavior in their life, you have someone that, you know, maybe has a drug problem or maybe hasn't had a stable living situation.
Or they're just a fucking scumbag.
That's right.
Plain and simple.
That's right. You can toughen the laws to make it adopt, you know, animals. You can, you know, have to prove some sort of proficiency for animal owners. I don't know what the laws are. I mean, I've never adopted an animal. I don't have an animal because I can't take care of myself, really. I can, but I'm struggling. And, you know, so therefore, it would be unfair for me to have an animal here where I'm living because mm-hmm. I don't have, you know, I'm not here. I can't give it the life that it deserves. But I wonder just what the criteria is for animal adoption if, you know, there's a background check, if there's any type of, you know, information known about the people that are adopting the animals. And then you have other animal sales, too. I mean, you have private individuals that could, you know, give away an animal or sell an animal. They never know who they're selling it to. So what I think what can be done is to at least strengthen the laws, the existing laws out there, to make sure that animals don't fall into the wrong hands.
Exactly, Bob. And I wanted to address everybody. Leaving your animal in pure shit, that's abuse too. That's one of the worst things you can do. I mean, just because you're not physically beating the animal, if you leave it in its own shit, that's awful too.
That's right, and I'm sure there are township ordinances against that. It's a very disgusting thing. It's really bad to do, and you know they have in New York City. They have, I mean, they've really gotten strict. I mean, you can get fined a lot of money for not picking up animal waste, and that's very important. So, you know, we are a country that loves dogs. I mean, there's just all animals. There's just no question about that. And unfortunately, you know, many animals are extinct throughout the world. And I was watching mm-hmm. something yesterday on Netflix with a friend of mine. This is really funny how you brought this up because it ties into what I was watching yesterday. It's called Undercover Boss. It's where the CEO goes undercover in you know, the company that he owns, and he talks to the workers. And he gets to learn, you know, what they go through during the course of a day. And he actually poses as a worker, and then that's it. It's funny because it's basically whoever put this Undercover Boss. I believe it's just a ode to CEOs. It's an attempt to make the CEOs seem more human and whatnot. It almost reminds me of the show I saw called Spouse Swap, or you know, where they go into home and the spouses trade place, and they always show the rich people as being disciplined and being harder workers, and the poor people are always lazy and they're a mess and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so they had this show, and they had the CEO who was the CEO of the Toronto Zoo. I didn't even know the Toronto Zoo existed. And this guy, he goes undercover, and he actually helps the zoo. He works in different areas in the zoo, and he preps the animals. And one of the things that they were talking about is one of the species of penguins are they're almost extinct. There's almost none of these type of, they're called African penguins. And none of these penguins actually exist, or there's very few of them. And they're trying to help these animals, and they're trying to breed them, and trying to, you know, save the species. And that's something that we really have to look at, because we depend on these animals to a great deal. And I would submit to you that it's all one battle. The battle to save animals, the battle to make our planet more sustainable and you know, harness certain alternative energies and protect animals is the same as it is to protect humans. Because if we can't protect humans, you know, if we impose austerity, we basically privatize our country, if we allow the oil companies to run wild, if we do all these different things and that we know kills humans, then how in the world can we care about animals? We don't care about anything. You know, we don't care about the earth. We don't care about anything. It's all about the mighty dollar. It's all about this fictional commodity known as money. Money does not exist. It's a fictional commodity. It's printed. You know, the folks over at the Zeitgeist Movement do a really good job in really going over the monetary system. But it's all one battle, Justin. The way I look at it, it's all part of the larger battle in battling, you know, the capitalists out there, battling the business interests out there. I mean, Jesus, you know, we slaughter animals just every day while we're friggin' drilling for oil.
I mean, it's to the point that it's sickening. And Bob, I wanted to go back on the subject that you were talking about in your podcast, because I really want to put my two cents in.
Yeah.
As far as public school or private school, I went to a public school, and I think public school is better because you're around different people, and really being around different races and different, you know, sex genders or whatever, it prepares you for the real world.
That's a great point. You're absolutely right. And you know, the thing about it is that the public schools, the private schools really don't have any type of accountability, and it goes. You know, people that rail against the public schools, and again, you know, there's a whole campaign to dismantle the public school unions and lower the wages and get rid of unions completely in America so that corporate America can have more control. We understand that. But the thing about it is public school systems are democratic institutions, because if you don't like the way your school is run, go join the school board. Go get involved. Go talk to the principal. You know, go support a candidate that you want to see run for the school board. You'll have a say over your school's curriculum. And all these people that bitch about the public school systems, they don't want to take the time to actually get involved with the school system out there. And
yeah, exactly.
Private school systems out there, charter schools and whatnot, they do not have the same level of accountability. They can pick and choose their students. They don't have to. They're just not equipped to deal with the mass amount of people that makes up who we are. Justin, we actually have 90 seconds left, so I want to kind of wrap it up here. If you want to give people your Facebook and Twitter and whatnot.
Absolutely, for both Facebook and Twitter, just Ray Harvey, and be sure to tune in next week for what's in Justin's head. I'll have a total new topic to discuss with Bob Carson.
Yes, very thought-provoking topic here. We got to get some music or something like that to, you know, I'll take a commercial break, and then we'll play the music building up, leading to the segment here. This has been a great segment. I had fun. I know the audience members out there have fun, and the thousands of people that will listen to this will have fun as well. Justin, I look forward to having you on next week for What's in Justin's Head. Thank you very much. People can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/Bob Carson MMA, twitter.com/Bob Carson MMA, And make sure to follow us on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen.
Show some respect.
Take care, Justin.
You too, Bob.
Thank you.